Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Eric Schwitzgebel, professor of philosophy at the University of California, Riverside. And we're talking about his book, A Theory of Jerks and Other Philosophical Misadventures. Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Eric Schwitzgebel, professor of philosophy at the University of California, Riverside. And we're talking about his book. This book is more fun than any other philosophy book I've read, A Theory of Jerks and Other Philosophical Misadventures. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
This book, and I meant that, I've done a lot of philosophy books. For some reason, I found this a lot more involving. I found that it was actually interesting ideas. They were short pieces, though. They're like 4 to 8 pages. Do you like writing in the short form?
I do like writing in the short form. I feel like it's hard to actually, for normal humans, to think through 20 pages without losing the thread and forgetting what was at the beginning. So I like, even my longer essays tend to be short pieces strung together.
And it really works, too, because, and then they're grouped sort of thematically. And so you'll take what, like, for instance, problems about ethical and moral problems about AI. Those essays are all grouped together. And although you recommend that people don't just start reading on page one, I did, and I thought there was a really great arc to all these essays.
Oh, okay, cool, thanks.
Now, before we talk about any individual essay, because we could spend an entire show just talking about any one essay, I want to talk about some of the stuff that you talked about at the end. There's a quote on page 260. Philosophy should not be conceptualized as a reflection on a particular, specific, profound topics. Rather, philosophy is a style of thinking, a willingness to plunge in to consider the most fundamental, ontological, normative, conceptual, and theoretical questions about anything. And when I came to that sentence, that really sort of struck me as how people both... people who are teaching philosophy and people when they think about philosophy, which most people probably don't, they probably have these misconceptions of what philosophy does. And it seems like your essays are always geared to sort of defy that. Is that true?
Yeah. Well, I also am interested in the stuff that philosophers in general are interested in and those big picture issues about that people think of as philosophical topics. But I've always also had this attraction to doing philosophy about things like, you know, what is it to be a jerk or what is it to have a haircut? You know, and I feel like you can do philosophy about that kind of stuff, and we do philosophy about that stuff. I was struck in my thinking about what philosophy is. You read the little piece on the philosopher of hair.
Yep.
When I was a graduate student at Berkeley, we had this humor board, and people had put kind of humorous things on the board. One person had put up this little newspaper clipping about a French barber who says he's a philosopher of hair, and everyone's kind of laughing about, well, that's ridiculous. And I'm thinking, I bet that guy really is a philosopher of hair. I mean, if you say that, you've probably got all of these opinions about what makes a good haircut and what a haircut is and whether the haircut needs to please the person who's on it to be good and stuff. And he's probably got all kinds of opinions about that, right? So why not have a philosophy of hair?
And this also relates to another essay. You talk about truth philosophers and dare philosophers. Talk to me about what the difference is between those two.
Right.
So except that both are into Madonna, apparently.
So this is a distinction that I got from Zach Barnett and Nomi Arpaly. And they think that some philosophers are more interested in kind of thinking about what must be true and trying to get at the truth, and they tend to go for moderate, reasonable, compromise positions, defend common sense positions. That tends to be where they go. And other philosophers are dare philosophers who are like, let's try this wild thing and just see if we can defend it. And they kind of think of philosophy almost as like this game of trying to find the most far out, interesting, novel thing that they can defend, even if it might not really be true in the end. So they identify those as two very different philosophical styles.
But you have a third.
Yes. So I thought that this we needed to add a wonder philosophers to this, because I didn't feel like I was either a truth or a dare philosopher. When I asked Nomi about it, she said, "Oh, I thought think of you as a dare philosopher because you say such weird stuff sometimes." But that didn't, her description of dare philosophy didn't seem to fit me very well, I thought. And what I think, it got me to thinking about what do I value in philosophy. And I think for me, part of it is the sense of wonder that philosophy can give.
Yeah.
Right? The idea about, wow, the world is weirder than we think, and you can wonder about all kinds of things, and you don't need to kind of get the truth handed to you on a plate. I think it's fascinating when we undercut what we think might have been true, when we create new ideas and new doubt. And it's not like the kind of dare kind of game. It's more like enjoying the wondrousness of the world.
Trust your sense of fun.
Yes, this is my advice to basically all philosophy graduate students and advanced undergrads. Right, so there are all these, in academia, you kind of often get told, well, this is what you should do, and this is the responsible thing to do, and here's this boring stuff that you need to master. And that can really be dispiriting. And I think when students, instead of kind of trying to do that, when they start thinking about what's fun, what do I find fun and interesting, what do I want to do, right, that following that, usually there's some intuitive thing in them that's learning. I mean, you've got this epistemic sense of what's fun to read. When you're bored, you're not learning, you're not engaged. When you're having fun, you are learning, and there's something in you that's like, this is cool, this is interesting, let's go with this. So I always like students to try to think about, and I in my own career have thought about, what do I find fun, what do I find interesting, what do I want to pursue? And then once I've done that for a while, I find myself doing the backfill work of the stuff that I would have previously thought was boring. Right? Because now I've figured out what's fun and what's interesting. And now it doesn't seem as bad to kind of to follow up on the main literature. But when you start with the boring thing, yeah, that takes all the air out of your tires.
It's like bad mathematics professors, and I've run into many people who will never do mathematics again because of the way it was taught.
Yeah, right. I mean, academia is often so boring. And
that leads me to another essay of yours that just had me on the floor. What's in people's stream of experience during philosophy talks?
Yes. I was doing all these studies with beepers, right? So
Wait, you got to tee this up, because this is a good idea. This is a classic example of what you're talking about. It's fun, but it actually gets to important points that are interesting.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think if you are interested in academic stuff in general, your sense of fun, you should follow that sense of fun, because probably there's some reason that you're being drawn toward that. There's something that you're picking up on. You might not even understand it yet, but there will always be some, almost always, I think, some kind of pot of gold at the end of that fun little rainbow that you're chasing. With the beeper stuff, so I've been giving people beepers to kind of have them report on what their ordinary experience is during the kind of day-to-day. So I'd be giving talks on this. So I decided, well, it'll be interesting to give people beepers while I'm talking. Right? So I set it up, and then I would give a talk, and then I'd have the about beeping, about this experience sampling, what's going on in your mind when the beep occurs. And then the beep would occur during my talk, and then I'd ask people right there on the spot, well, okay, what was going on in your stream of experience when that beep happened? And to my kind of disappointment and surprise, they're almost never thinking about the talk. They're always thinking about stuff like, well, I've got this weird taste of skanky coffee in my mouth, and I was noticing that the orange of the flyer, or I was seeing how your arms were flapping about, and I was wondering whether there's any meaning in that. Right? Hardly ever thinking about the actual content of the talk.
When I read that, because I'm a person who gives lectures too, I'll tell you, that struck fear, but also humor into my heart, because I knew you sort of suspected that all along, but you didn't want to really know it. And thanks to you, now we now know it. Some of the stuff that people were thinking about.
Everywhere else.
What the hell is a macaroni orange?
I'm imagining this Kraft macaroni and cheese.
Oh, okay. Oh, the orange of the Kraft macaroni. I thought there was actually an orange made of macaroni. But what you did find out, too, is there are two things that will compel an audience's attention when you're giving a lecture. One is when something unexpected happens, like a cat walks on a stage, all of a sudden everybody's there.
Totally. Yes. When a cat walks on a stage, or if you drop something, like, boom, everyone's attention is there.
And then when you take too long a pause.
And when you take a pause. I love using pauses in my talks now. Because you take a pause, and if you hold it for like 2 seconds, like suddenly everyone wakes up and looks at you. It doesn't take long, but like all the attention is there, is suddenly there. And then you can say that sentence.
So this, does this mean that your study has actually affected the way that you've lectured?
Yeah, I think it has.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
So I do slow down more and give pauses and try to do things to regather the audience's attention, yeah.
Now, you also have a great criticism, and I want to thank you. There's so many essays. I actually had this deep feeling of, wow, I'm glad somebody finally wrote this down. A criticism of poor writing and philosophy. And another quote from this essay, which is on, I think, page 264, is, philosophy is not a wordless, profound insight. Philosophy is prose. And the writings of people like Kant and Hegel, you know, people, they're notoriously dense and tough to read. Yet everybody goes, well, you know, that's because it's so, you know, interesting. And people are able, willingly, to forgive the really poor writing. But really good philosophy should be written well.
I agree, and I think the poor writing actually becomes a kind of disguise and an excuse. You can hide behind poor writing. You can hide unclear ideas behind poor writing. So, and then if you have a kind of intellectual authority on top of that, right, then people are confused by your writing, and if they think of some criticism, you can just say, well, you're confused, right? That's not it, because obviously it's not subject to that obvious criticism, right? So this kind of duck and weave behind poor writing. If someone both has intellectual authority as, oh, this person's a genius, and they have poor writing, then they exude this kind of aura of, well, it's so profound and confusing.
I can't understand
criticism. I can't understand it.
Therefore, it must be good.
It can't be that Kant is making an obvious mistake, right?
Well, excuse me for golfing. You have it in for Kant in this book.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it. You have a very fascinating essay, and I've run into this about artists. I taught at an art museum for 40 years. And people were really, other curators would be very willing to forgive all sorts of excruciatingly bad behavior because the art was good. And you know, and you're talking about Immanuel Kant, and I did not know this because when I went in my philosophy classes, I never learned this, that he's really an asshole.
Well.
Yeah, he is. Come on. Come on, I need you to say it.
I do want to distinguish between his personal behavior, about which I'm not an expert, and his opinions.
Which
He's
are
got
written
some
down.
Really horrible opinions. And yes, expressing those opinions is already partway toward being an asshole. Right?
I mean, his opinions about wives, servants, homosexuals, masturbation, killing bastards, and organ donation. I have to believe that if you're writing that down, I don't care. I don't need to know about your personal life because you're a jerk.
Yeah.
Now, why aren't we taught the full range of Kant? Why is everything sort of polished?
Well, I think philosophers like to have heroes, and they like to then show the best sides of the heroes, and they don't like to show the other sides. And Kant is one of the great heroes in all of philosophy, so people don't want to point out that he had these horrible views about, you know, black people being intellectually inferior.
Oh, horrible, horrible.
And literally he says that if there's a bastard, a child is born out of wedlock, then it's morally permissible to kill that person because the person is born out of the authority of the state. And so anybody born out of the authority of the state doesn't merit the protection of the state. So,
wow.
So he concludes that it's okay to kill children who are born out of wedlock.
But, I mean, when I read this essay, I had a sea change in the way I thought about Immanuel Kant. So is it legitimate to just sort of say, okay, these parts over here are fine, but the rest of the stuff he wrote is we just won't think about it? I think we need to think about it, right? We need to know that in order to get a full picture of who the person was.
I do think you need to know it in order to get a full picture of who he was as a philosopher. And it helps us really understand, if you want to really understand what when Kant is saying egalitarian-seeming things, like that we should have concern for everybody and everyone's life is worth the same, right? When you see how he applies that to bastards, or yeah. doesn't apply it to bastards and to black people, or doesn't fully apply it to black people, then you're like, wait, maybe he doesn't mean what we would naturally
yes.
think he means when
yes.
he says that. Right, and likewise, some of his arguments on these applied issues are so bad.
Well, transcendental deduction? You call it shoddy work and incoherent.
Well, here's the thing, right? When you look at his argument against masturbation, when you look at his argument for killing bastards, they are really bad arguments, but they've got that Kantian feel. But we can tell that they're bad because the conclusions are clear. And we already know the conclusions are bizarre and wrong,
yeah.
right? Now, with something like his famous arguments for the transcendental deductions, this is famously dense, difficult, almost impossible to understand piece of the text, right?
Yeah.
So if you think, well, Kant is just such a genius that he would never give a bad, incoherent argument, then you think, well, of course it's got to be great, and I just don't understand it. The fault is mine. But once you see Kant as the kind of guy who could give these horrible arguments for killing bastards and against masturbation, and you're like, well, maybe this is one of those horrible arguments. Maybe the fact that I don't understand it and doesn't seem to make any sense is because it doesn't really make any sense underneath. And it really is a piece of shoddy work, but somehow Kant has this mystique about him.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Eric Schwitz-Abel, professor of philosophy at the University of California, Riverside. And we're talking about his book, which for me was one of the most enjoyable books to read of the last year, A Theory of Jerks and Other Philosophical Misadventures. You know, following that essay is another essay that is really interesting, too. Will future generations find us morally loathsome? You know, there's this sort of feeling like we're at the pinnacle of morality, that especially if you're in philosophy of ethics, that we know what it is. But is it entirely possible that 100 years down the line, future philosophers and ethics and people who study ethics and morals will find us morally loathsome? The example you give is Rousseau and Therese. That's a horrible – I mean, you know, you read that and you're talking about their deeds. That's a case where we know what the deeds were. And you make that case that there is every possibility that we're not at the pinnacle of moral righteousness. We're just on a route.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Rousseau, I mean, this one of the most famous ethicists and political philosophers in Western history, right? He had five children with Therese, and he, against her objections, demanded that all five of them be sent to orphanages after they were born. This is in a time when most Parisian orphanages were having mortality rates of 50% to 90% of the children per year, right? So he's basically condemning all five of these children to death, his own children, against the protests of his wife. And, you know, then he regretted it later. There was one boy, and he tried to find the boy later, and he couldn't find the boy, unsurprisingly, right, because the boy disappeared and died, presumably, right? I mean, there are other ways in which Rousseau is a really loathsome person. He is a terrible, horrible person in so many ways, and that's a really concrete one. And yet he's also this kind of great and admired ethicist. And I do wonder whether, you know, future generations will look at us and look at our ethicists and think, wow, they were so horrible.
Yeah, they write these great essays, but, you know, after the ecological collapse of the planet, they were driving around in the SUVs and and using lots of plastics. And it's, you know, this is not an idle thought problem. It's I think it's a real issue.
Right. So I think, you know, it's hard to know what future generations will really think is terrible. But if we imagine catastrophic climate change that causes, say, a billion more people to die than would otherwise die, and then we think of, say, me, I just imagine myself because I don't want to blame anybody else, but me driving around in my minivan in my air-conditioned home with my luxurious use of the planetary resources and my travel across the globe flying everywhere, right? People might look at that and think, wow, you know, he knew, or he should have known, that climate change was at a risk of being seriously catastrophic. And what did he do? He just led a kind of ordinary upper middle class lifestyle, you know. And furthermore, we now have videos.
Like, oh, my God, you're right.
If like Rousseau had taken home videos of his babies and then done it, we would have been, you know, even more mortified, right? So,
God.
I share the videos, you know, of my family in Iceland, right, watching the iceberg calf, right? Like, oh, they flew to Iceland and they watched the glaciers receding and they thought it was great.
Oh, my God. We're going to run out of time. I want to talk about one of your essays as a great example of how you can just muck around with people's heads. Is the United States literally conscious? Now, when I read the title of that, I went, come on. And yet you make a case for it.
Yeah. I spent...
this is a philosopher having fun. This is a philosopher having fun.
This is definitely a fun one. I mean, if you look at most... theory, materialist theory. So most philosophers are materialists in the sense that they think that basically we're just biological organisms. There's no immaterial soul.
Well, you know, but the United States isn't a biological organism.
Well, you think not? Why not? It's an organism. It has parts. The parts interact to support each other.
Yeah.
Right? If you think of individual people in the United States something like cells in a superorganism, right? Then you've got some farmer-type cells that grow food and then distribute it to other parts of the body. You've got a central government that controls the behavior of the organism.
But a person would argue...
boundaries that are protected.
Oh, my God. But a person would argue that no single conscious organism has parts that are also conscious.
Yeah, I'm not sure why. There's some philosophers who've said that, but I'm not sure why that would have to be the case.
Okay.
Right? So when we think about... I mean, we can do conceptual thought experiments about hive minds.
Yeah.
Right.
And right. Right.
You can imagine maybe an entity who's got, say, insects that exchange information as its mind. I have some more extended thought experiments on this in a longer paper on the topic. And I mean, it's a stretch. This is closer to one of my DARE type of essays. But let me just also say there's a theoretical case to be built. Because if you look at most of these materialist theories of mind, these materialist theories of consciousness, and you just apply them straightforwardly, they say things like consciousness arises out of complex looping information processing. Well, that happens in the United States among the people of the United States. They say things like consciousness arises out of self-representational systems, right? Well, the United States is a self-representational system. Right, there's a group level of understanding of what's going on in the group level. If you look at most of the materialist theories of consciousness and you just apply it straightforwardly to the United States conceptualized as an organism with people as its parts, the result tends to be that's a conscious organism with real stream of experience. So this is bizarre.
It is bizarre. Yeah, you won me over in the end, like dragging my feet and screaming all the while. But that leads to all sorts of other problems. Before we go, we could talk about any one essay for the whole thing. You have a great section on AI and moral and ethical issues.
Yeah.
And I've interviewed a lot of people who are involved in AI, and I just get this feeling none of them are thinking about these issues. They're just trying to do it. And then we'll worry about the moral issues afterwards. But there was a very practical one that you talked about that we're sort of on the verge of. That is, your automatic driving car, should it be allowed to kill you?
Right.
I thought that was a real problem that could happen.
Yeah, I think it is a real problem that can happen. So we have driverless cars or automated autonomous vehicles, and they will sometimes be in emergency accident situations, and there will be an algorithm to decide what to do, right? And this algorithm is going to implicitly or explicitly have some set of priorities about how much risk to inflict on the passengers for the sake of not killing, say, a pedestrian, right? So how risky a maneuver will this vehicle engage in order to not kill a pedestrian, just as one specific concrete example? Like, will it run you near the edge of the cliff? Will it run you over the cliff, right? If there are three pedestrians it would otherwise kill, right? Should it just say, okay, right? Three is more than one, so the driver's going to go and just, you know, steer you off the cliff.
The real problem comes, and this is true for several of your essays, it seems that when corporate America or corporate, the global corporate consciousness gets involved in these issues, you know, you talk about people could maybe dial down the ethics of their car. You know, like, no, protect right. me at all costs. And then there'll be other cars that say, no, you know, save
That's
pedestrians.
Right.
And you have this very weird situation where ethical decisions are being made on many different levels, depending upon the corporate entity.
Yeah, absolutely. So the conclusion of that essay is that all of this should be made explicit and publicly debated, right? Because there will be some people, right? You can imagine an extreme case of a car that would never risk even a small injury to the driver, even a 5% chance of a small injury to the driver for the safety of any pedestrian, right? Would rather run down and kill a pedestrian than risk a 5% chance of the airbag going off and the driver, you know, being stunned from that, right? That would be an immoral, I think, thing to program into a car, right? But we don't know what the algorithms are. Google,
That's right.
in particular,
That's right.
has argued that the algorithms should not be made public and should be kept proprietary. But they're ethical algorithms, and the society should be thinking about this and figuring out what kinds of ethical algorithms in collision cases are permissible or ethical to have in driverless cars.
We're completely out of time, Eric, and I feel like I want to talk for another 5 hours about this book. My guest tonight has been Eric Schoesgabel, a professor of philosophy at the University of California, Riverside, and we're talking about his book. I cannot recommend it enough. A Theory of Jerks and Other Philosophical Misadventures. Eric, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.